Well, this is one from a couple of days ago. I think maybe if you, even if you have just arrived yesterday, you know that there was a spate of occasions where elderly people about to die in their hospital beds were spiritually assaulted, I think is a good word, by one of their maybe children or grandchildren who were extremists, and they said, "Mummy, Daddy, you have to convert to being a Christian, otherwise you'll go to hell." And the solution to that, which I suggested, was the only way to get a bit of peace and quiet is to convert, to tell your son or grandson, "Okay, I'll become a Christian," and as soon as they go out of the room, convert back again. And the question here is, then, if he agrees to convert and after they leave, he just converts back, isn't this lying? Yeah, well, I think you're about to die, and for a bit of peace and quiet, you say, "Okay, I will convert," and then you convert back again. That's one of the only ways to get rid of such crazy people. But it may be a skillful means. If you can find a better skillful means, please let me know. But apparently, that was causing so much trouble in many countries that they made that illegal. So it's harassment. Is there a nice, kind way to provide negative feedback in the workplace after providing some positive feedback, the objective to improve performance? And of course there is. So you just, it's the old sandwich method in the workplace, performance assessment. You talk to a person, first of all, make them feel valued. Some people feel cared for. And if they feel cared for and valued, then they will accept criticism. A lot of times when you get criticized in the workplace without any praise whatsoever, you think, "I work so hard for this company, I do so much, and is this what they do to me? They don't appreciate all the good things which I do." Of course, which means they don't take the criticism in a positive way. But if you establish that that you actually care for the people who work for you, and you really have their best interests in mind, you establish that by some positive reinforcement, and then you talk about some of the bad things or some of the things they're doing, and keep it, as I said the other day, never criticize a person or just criticize the act. You're not a foolish, incompetent, stupid person. It's just what you did was just not up to standard. Can you improve? You always make sure that they don't take that as diminishing your respect for them. You finish off with some kindness and some praise as well. So that way people can accept the negative comments. They realize they can't, in a way, you really want to help them. What is the best way to encourage my father to start meditating? He's 73 years old, he gives a lot of dana, and he's a very honest and upright life and still works full time at 73 years of age. But cannot be motivated to meditate. I'm not quite sure what his views on reincarnation are. Thank you, Ajahn. First of all, give him a nice simple way to meditate, not force. A lot of people are Buddhists. They have got to view meditation as sitting for hours and hours with aching knees and having to force the mind and you can't move. So keep a nice, kind and gentle meditation. And just for a short period of time, you see if you can encourage him to, at the end of every little meditation, just to feel what it's like afterwards and see what the results are. As long as he does it in a proper way, he sees results straight away and doesn't mind doing it. So, a little bit of marketing, a little bit of encouragement, take away the fear of meditation, and then it is more attractive to people. How does one apply meditation gently and appropriately? where one is constantly down with illness and physical pain. If you're always down with illness and physical pain, it's a type of meditation which you perform. And of course, because you're with illness and physical pain, you can't do very much. At least one thing you have is plenty of time when you're sick. Many people, you can see them lying in a hospital bed, or in your own bed. Now, how do you actually use that time? Some people have their TV sets on all the day, or sometimes they just fall asleep. But what a lovely thing to do is to do that meditation where you just make peace with your illness. You care for it instead of trying to cure it, and be very gentle with yourself. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And then you find that your sicknesses get less intense. The pain eases off. I know that I've done that many, many times. Simply just use this meditation, find it's a wonderful thing to do when you're sick or when you're in pain. I'm going to tell the story again. When I had food poisoning. When I was in my cave. And the reason I decided to tell that story is because after you were falling asleep, and so was I. And so when I go, quite a few people woke up. I was supposed to disturb your slumber. But in really, that's no exaggeration. I was in agony, and you know what to do. You just observe, be mindful of that pain, and be kind to it. Very weak. And the kindness softened the pain. And I just kept on doing that for 20 minutes until the whole thing disappeared totally. Then I came back again. That's a quite intense pain when you have food poisoning and you're screaming. So it was intense pain, just 20 minutes and it was totally gone. It's very promising, isn't it? If you could do that, so you're sick in pain, see if you can meditate properly. The awareness, the mind, you can feel the body, you can't feel anything else. It dominates your consciousness if you're really in pain. So find out what makes it worse, what makes it better. It's always let you be, let you go, makes it much, much better. And then soon you can just relax the pain all the way. Dear Angie brought up a good point today on the effects of saying no to our kids. I try talking nicely to my preschool children, but they just don't listen. So I ended up shouting and saying no to them. Is there a better way? Being kind does not seem to work so far. Depends how old the kids are, and depends on how independent they are, what culture they come from. If you try shouting and saying no to your kids in the United States, you would just get into more trouble. They would probably go to their school counselor and accuse you of abuse. And they'd probably get away with it. So it is all time and place. But if you have to say no to your kids, that of course is that negative reinforcement, always saying no. So there is more skillful means. Again, just where I came from, my father used to not use negative reinforcement, not say no, but he used emotional intelligence on me. He had heaps of that. Because that, remember him saying to me, son, never steal. Why not? If you want something that bad, you really want it that bad, you're willing to risk getting caught by stealing something, just come and ask me and I'll get it for you, no questions asked. And he was a poor man. I realized he couldn't afford those things. But I realized from that how much he would sacrifice to stop me stealing. It wasn't just saying no, it's a bad thing to do. It made me realize that I'd rather, you know, just not be able to pay this bill or that bill, just to stop you stealing. And that really made me think of me, just how can you steal? So kids' behaviour, saying no to them, sometimes they will just run away and keep on doing it. Or they will do it without you finding out. So saying no is not really a powerful thing. Sometimes that depends on what the situation is, how old they are. Sometimes you need to use some other methods. Try and find out why they're doing things you don't want them to do. Look, what makes them just go against their parents' wishes and make the parents unhappy? Why are they doing that? As what you're asking them, is that a reasonable request of them? You know, sometimes you ask them to do things which embarrass them amongst their peers. So there's so many reasons why, you know, just saying no to a kid is not really going to have a long-lasting effect. Shouting at them is just your frustration. People don't listen to what you're saying. They don't just listen to the fact you're shouting. So it's just the power of the words rather than the message which those words contain. So be very careful shouting. There's usually much, much, much better ways to actually to get kids to do what you want them to do, or get them to do the wise things. And one of the good ways of getting your children to have good habits is letting them associate with other good kids. Peer pressure is so powerful for children. So you take them to things like a Buddhist fellowship youth group, you know, where there's other kids who are really nice, good, wonderful children. That helps them enormously. So much more than anything you can do. Oh, there was that case of a Malaysian man whose, this particular son, it was the first year in university. And his grades were going down, 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 because he was spending too much time going out at night with his girlfriend, going to the nightclub or having a good time. And mum and dad kept on telling him, look, if you carry on like this, you get thrown out of university. And did their son listen? Not at all. So the father decided to use another method. Everyone has got their weak point. And it's called the point of leverage. For him, the son, it was his girlfriend. He wouldn't listen to his mother and father, but my goodness, he would listen to his girlfriend. So one evening when he came back late again with his girlfriend, the father was waiting for them outside the house. Come inside, he said to both of them. And of course the girlfriend followed. The son was really embarrassed. What's my dad up to? He's embarrassing me. But inside the house he sat them both down and he just talked with his son's girlfriend. He told me the conversation went something like, you've been going out for quite a while now. I'm not sure where your relationship is. It's probably just beginning. But who knows, one day you may decide to take the relationship further and, you know, maybe get engaged and get married, and that might happen. It's a possibility. And I'm sure, you know, to the girlfriend, I'm sure you would never want to marry someone who doesn't finish his university degree. And the girlfriend said, no, it's no problem, he's going to university, but his grades are going down, he's about to get kicked out. Oh, he never told me that, said the girlfriend. But I just thought I'd let you know. Good night and have a good evening. And that was all that was necessary. From that day on, as they say in the English language, the girlfriend was on his case. Have you finished your assignment? Have you got it in on time? how much did you get for that sort of essay? Did you get a good grade? And he would never listen to his parents. But my goodness, he had to listen to his girlfriend. And his grades went up, 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 and eventually he graduated. Now that is how to get a son to follow orders. Especially if he's the girlfriend. If he hasn't got a girlfriend, find one for him. Find one who you can just control. If you've got power over the girlfriend, you've got 100% power over the kid. So that's it worked. It's a beautiful way of doing things. Dear Ajahn, you often talk about being mindful and present, but there's also a teaching about contemplation and reflection. So I'm confused when I should be present and when I should reflect. With our busy daily schedule, difficult to have time to reflect and meditate. I'm not sure if you were here when I gave the simile on what contemplation is. Remember when I held this up, for those of you who were there, the first part of the retreat, I asked people, what is it I'm holding up? And they answered, bottle, plastic. I said, keep on going. What else do you see? Keep on. What else do you see? What else do you see? Until you get to the point you run out of names. That's called contemplation. Just naming and labeling is a bottle of water. You put it down, you look no deeper, you get no real insight. You just know what everyone else knows. But if you take something, you know still enough to be able to look at something for a long time, then you see things you've never seen before. You have perceptions which you have not been taught before. You go way beyond the realm of labels to seeing things in a different way. That's called contemplation. So in order to contemplate, you have to be not mindful, but also to be still. And when you do that, it happens naturally. You can't miss it. Sometimes when you're very, very strongly mindful, really powerfully mindful, then you look at something and just grab your attention. It's amazing. And you play around with it, you see things in there you've never seen before. It's also delightful to do. So the whole of these practices are not something you do. It's things which happen in spite of you. Just make peace and be kind, be gentle. Just be mindful and care. And then this whole thing opens up. So that's actually how you gain your wisdom. What is your take on Mahasi and Goenka Vipassana methods as forms of study for Tana? I did say to you that on the flight from Perth to Singapore before I transited to the Silk Air flight to come here to Phuket, sitting next to a gentleman, we had a nice conversation because he had done some meditation, Vipassana, and decided he never wanted to do it ever again because it was too painful, too tough. And so I was describing to him where all this Vipassana tradition came from. It is not an ancient part of Buddhist meditation. Its origin came from the original Mahasi Sayadaw, who passed away quite a long time ago. And that Mahasi Sayadaw thought that lay people could never get jhanas. So he decided to teach a second class meditation for lay people, the Vipassana tradition as we know it today. He was a Burmese monk who was wise and knowledgeable enough to know that jhana is the meditation the Buddha used and recommended. If we get to it tomorrow on the word of the Buddha, you can see from the suttas, the mouth of the Buddha, the only meditation the Buddha recommended is jhanas. Samasamadhi, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, is jhanas. Jhanas, 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 jhanas. But because that needs a lot of letting go, perhaps he thought it was impossible for lay people. The same with the Vietnamese tradition, so I was told. Long time ago, they had a meeting and decided not to teach jhana meditation for lay people. They thought it was just going to waste the time of the monks. They changed their mind since. But the Maharaja would practice the jhana himself. And that was the original teaching from the monks. And then you got people like Goenka, who was, I'm not sure if he was really a Buddhist, I think he was a Hindu, he was certainly an Indian gentleman, who took that teaching and again sort of separated it out from the rest of the Buddhism and sort of taught that. It had some results, but it also has some dangers as well. I've certainly come across many people who have been psychologically damaged by that technique. For most people it is fine, but for many people, quite a considerable number, not the majority by any means, they are already psychologically fragile. And they go to that tradition to find out some cure for their depression or anxieties or traumas of the past. And it's such a forceful tradition, many of the fragile meditators, they break. And you know, some have a great deal of difficulties. And one of the main reasons is because there's no kindness involved in there. It's just force. Some of the monks who are with me, they used to do that vipassana. And it did actually become, especially Goenka, like a cult. If you come on this retreat, now you meditate with Ajahn Brahm, you won't be able to go to a Goenka retreat. You're banned. You come to our retreat and no others. And to me that is a sign of a cult. What are you afraid of? Listen to other teachers. So it is a danger. We've got many good things in there. And just like I said today, I unfortunately didn't get the best translation, which I'll go through quickly tomorrow, that when people say this is the only way, Satipatthana, Vipassana, that's totally against the teachings of the Buddha. It never says that. So anyway, that's one of the things you have to be quite forceful on that, because you know, there's too many cases. It's not benign. It's a dangerous technique. Most people it's fine, but for some, they get damaged. Anyway, how can contemplation of mind be different from contemplation of mind objects? Can you leave that until tomorrow? Because I never finished the contemplation of mind objects there. And I never mentioned the point which I will emphasize tomorrow because it wasn't in that rendering which I showed on the board. Traditionally, the oldest form of the Satipatthana Sutta was the mind objects were only the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. All the rest were added later on. There's great research which is done comparing all the different manuscripts, ancient manuscripts of Satipatthana Sutta, to see how they've actually added on things over the centuries. But can we leave that until tomorrow for the sutta class, and I'll go more into that then. Dear Ajahn, will chanting before meditation give us a help to reach stillness? It can do, because chanting can be inspiring, especially if you know what you're chanting. If you don't know what you're chanting, sometimes it can be melodious, it can be uplifting. So, if the chanting is inspiring, then it is a help. However, sometimes, actually my chanting is not that bad, but I remember in the morning and evening chanting which we used to do in Northeast Thailand, which went on for such a long time, especially the chanting we used to do on the morning after meditating all night on the moon nights. And that was such terrible chanting that I was traumatized by that. Honestly, because it was just leftist. It's done 9 years of that, and now when I hear the Tung Wok blare done by the Mayhawk in the northeast, it was excruciating. These old ladies hadn't slept all night. It was just so uninspiring. So you can chant if it inspires you. If it uplifts you, gives you some energy, then it's really helpful. Otherwise, no need. I am a beginner in meditation. You have mentioned many times to look inside. I do not understand what look inside meant, or introversion. Can you please provide example of looking inside so I can unfold the petals? You have a choice of looking outside. For example, someone bangs a door and your mind goes outside to that sound. It's none of your business. Someone are banging the door, so why do you actually allow the mind to go outside? And this is your home here, inside your body, inside your mind. Why do you have to leave and go outside? So instead we have this idea of looking inside, not looking at anybody else, what they're saying, but how we're reacting to what they're saying. We're looking inside here. We're not going off into the past or the future, going out. We're going inside of time. When I gave a long time ago, there was some anniversary of the Perth Astronomical Society. It may have been because I knew I was a physicist before, but they wanted to get some religions and science to meet together. And so we had a little symposium, and there was a Catholic scientist there, astronomer, and she was very honest and said how conflicted she was when she looked through a telescope at the vastness of the universe, because that conflicted with many of the things which she had to believe from the Christian Bible. She was honest enough to say just how she had a lot of difficulty reconciling her religion with science. And when it was my turn, I took that up and I said, never mind, because many scientists would also have conflict if they looked at the thick end of the telescope to the thin end and tried to find out who was watching this. Look the other way down the telescope. Who's doing the watching? What is consciousness? What is mind? There they will have the conflict. But like science looks out into the world. Religion looks the other way down the microscope. Who is behind this eye, EYE, looking at all of this stuff? Who is writing down all of the notes and keeping the data? Who is working out how this all works? That's actually going inside instead of going out. So it's a different perspective. It's a very good question. And for those of you who want to take it further, I got this from the philosopher, Buddhist monk, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. And I'm not sure if this is what he meant, but this is how I understood it. The meaning of the word Dhamma. What actually is Dhamma? Dhamma is not the name of a cat. That's Peter's cat. what actually Dhamma is this experience now, looking back where it came from, its cause, its origin. That is Dhamma. This experience looking for where it came from, its causes, the why. And so the other part of in Pali language is called atta. It's actually where it's going to, where it is, what's its consequences. So it's going to the causes of things, the source, the laws, the underlying laws of nature, the causes, for why things go up and go down again. The laws of nature, the underlying fabric which works its way out as our experience. That was like the word Dhamma, and I thought it was really cool. Anyway, dearest Ajahn Brahm, I have the following questions. Remember what PJ said, one question, not one, two, I'm not three in the back, but it's double page. I have the following questions. What is the objective and purpose of meditation at a cemetery in front of a tomb? Must everyone go through this to gain enlightenment? Do you recommend a lay person to go through this form of cemetery meditation? Not necessary, unless you're afraid of ghosts. When you go to a cemetery, you won't find a ghost there. So, sometimes just to confront your fear. You know what happens if fear is like you're running away from something, and then when you turn around, whatever it was chasing you runs away from you. I said the story earlier today about when I went on to Bunbury Beach, a town south of Perth, meditating, and when I came out of meditation, two beautiful girls in bikinis on either side of me. But another time when I went to meditate there, I had stones thrown at me. And it was a time when they had that Indian guru, Rajneesh. And he had a lot of disciples in Perth. And he was threatening to come to Perth. He sent some of his senior organizers. And this Marshall, I think her name was, and she was so gross, she upset almost everybody. But of course the newspapers loved that, so she was a celebrity. And these were days when people didn't know who was who in the religious world. So when I was meditating on the beach, just minding my own business, I heard the whistle of a stone coming past my ear. And then I heard these kids shout out, "Get off our beach, Rajneeshi!" But much worse than that. And then another stone came past, I was a long way away, so the aim wasn't that good. And then another one, and I realized, even though the aim wasn't good, the law of probabilities meant soon enough a stone would hit. So I had to do something. So I got up out of my meditation, and instead of doing what most people do, run away, I stood up, turned around, and walked slowly towards the people throwing their stones. And there was about six or seven kids. There's only one gentle monk. What did those kids do? They ran away. Except for one who stayed, and he was really quite scared that I was walking up to him. So I was, "What are you doing that for? I'm a Buddhist monk." "Oh, we've got your Rajneeshi, sorry." But that's like even ghosts, when you walk towards them and running away from them, they lose all their power. And you've got scare power. But anyway, when I was wandering, doing my wandering time in Thailand, and got advice from Ajahn Chah, he'd always say, just at night time, just go to the cemetery, the charnel grounds. Because when you go there at night time, no lay people will come and bother you. And they're so peaceful. So that was a tough place I could go to get away from everybody. And if I didn't do that, people keep bothering me at night time. And it wasn't just to ask questions about meditation and Dhamma. Wandering monks, especially Westerners, we have a really good reputation for giving accurate lottery numbers. So they wouldn't come and ask anything, just wanted a lottery number, that's all. So I'm not going to waste my evening for that. So that's why I always say, go to the jungles, go to the burning grounds, Bali village, you can have a nice peaceful night, I always did. So I love those charnel grounds. So you don't have to meditate in front of a tomb. If you're really attached to your bodies and you don't sort of understand death, that's a good thing to do. But you don't want to imagine Charles Great simply is about death. Again, you see some of the visual aids which I have here, only a few of them. He would often pick up a glass like this and say, can you see the crack in the glass? And I look at it. So I can't see the crack. There's no crack there. Maybe you're cracked at your charge. And he said, no, no, there's a crack there. The reason you can't see it is it's microscopic. There's a crack here, though. Because one day someone will drop this glass, or they'll kick it, it'll fall over, and it will break. It is the crack of impermanence. Anicca. He said, because I can see that crack, said Ajahn Chah, and I'm telling you to look at that crack too, that's why you should be very careful, very mindful, and care for this glass. If you're not careful, it will break, you won't be able to use it again. But he said, if this was a plastic glass, you will need to care for it. You kick it, drop it, squash it, it's unbreakable. But because it's fragile, that is why you must care. Because one day you will die, you're cracked, every one of you, some of you are more cracked than others. Because you are cracked, that's why we must care. Because your relationships are cracked. You're not going to last forever. They're impermanent. That is why you must care. When we just mistakenly, out of delusion or wishful thinking, think, and many people do this, think they're going to live forever. They're unbreakable. That's when we don't care. If you think your relationship is solid, it's not going to break. That's when you don't care for it. You don't put any effort in your relationship. So this is actually what death teaches us. It teaches us the importance of caring. If grandfather has died, you will die, I will die. So because of that, that's why we care. Otherwise, we need to. What was the question? I don't know what it is. It's more than this question. During meditation upon gaining concentration, please don't gain concentration, gain stillness. What should I do to gain first jhana? Nothing. Except you disappear and stop doing stuff. Can you elaborate the steps in more detail, please? You can find that in that book, Happiness Through Meditation. You still got any left there in the back, Eileen? Yeah, got some, yeah. You mentioned to be kind and gentle after concentration setting, after stillness setting. But how to be kind when you are alone meditating? Kind towards who? You don't need to be kind towards a person. You can be kind towards things. Try being kind towards your car. I've done that before. There's this poor old Veronica over in Perth. They just finished one of the youth group meetings and they were just about to go to the beach. I forget what they were going to do down the beach. It's a nice summer's day, you know. Young people never ask them otherwise. But anyway, the boot of one of the cars was stuck and they couldn't open it. And then I was just walking back from some little ceremony I'd just been doing. I said, oh, he's a champagne, he's got psychic powers, he could open the boot for us, it's really important. And it was Veronica's car, I said, look, if I open the boot of your car, will you promise to be a nun? And she never believed I could do it, so she said, yes. So I opened the car and opened up the first time. She was really embarrassed. Ah, I'm going to become a nun. But fortunately, she was saved because one of the other friends about to go out, she was just a young lawyer, said, yes, she'll become a nun, but she never said when. Lawyers. But what I did was kindness. That's the only psychic power. Kindness to the car. And you ask Ajahn Brahmali, I had my cement mixer. I used to do a lot of work the first years I was a monk, and I went with the Anicca to get that cement mixer. It was my cement mixer. I looked after it. Other monks could not get it to work. I always could. Sometimes just stroke it. And then pull the string and it will work first time. Weird, isn't it? But the best story of all was this German young man who spent 1 year at Bodhinyana Monastery. And I saw him again when I went to Frankfurt to do some teachings. And he told me this story, and I didn't believe it. I said, well, this is a weird story. I am absolutely honest with you. He said, yes, I'm not going to lie to you. Are you sure? Many times. So I take it that it really happened. First day at university, on the campus, he passed the ATM machine. And he said the ATM machine, as soon as he passed, it emitted a sound. He called it a gurgling sound. And he interpreted that, he perceived that, as that ATM machine welcoming him onto campus. And so he would always use that ATM machine for his transactions. Because he'd been in my monastery, he gave it loving kindness. A nice ATM. So I hope you never run out of money. I hope people don't shout at you when they find they've got no balance left. I hope no one ever tries to rob you. And you might think he was crazy, but he did that for many months. You know, being kind to a machine. And this is what he said. I said, are you sure this happened? He said, yes, absolutely sure. He was sitting having his lunch, just maybe 10 or 20 meters from the ATM machine, on a bench outside, a warm day. And he heard the ATM make the same gurgle when he first came onto campus. He'd been there for 10 or 15 minutes. No one had been near the ATM machine. And he looked at that ATM machine after it made the gurgle, and a 20-euro note came out of the machine. No one had put in any credit cards or typed any codes on that machine. And the 20-euro note just came out. And he was stunned. He went to that machine, picked it up, he waved it around. Does this belong to anybody? No one claimed it, of course. So if you're ever that short of cash, find an ATM machine, give it loving kindness. Really good loving kindness. Nice ATM machine, nice ATM machine. Come on, cough up. So, you can, and many people tell me this, they've learned this, and especially their cars, the car breaks down. And you're kind to it, and it works. Weird, it does. Your computer, it crashes. Don't get angry at it. Be kind to it. And, you know, we've done this so many times in monasteries, and it's amazing when it works. How do you do that? It's kindness. It seems to have power over things, let alone just people. So if you can be kind to machines, you can be kind to your mind. Oh, poor old mind. We give you a hard time. Always pushing you this way and pushing you that way. You can be just kind to your mind. So whatever your experience, listen, if you want to become a mind today, that's fine. If you want to leave it to another 10 lifetimes, that's fine, buddy. It's really gentleness and kindness. So you can be kind towards anything. So that's actually how you do that. What did that mean when you said after concentration one should try to go into the first dharma? What are the steps? It's all these stages of letting go. The more you let go, the closer you will get to those stages. It's not what you do, it's not what you achieve. It's just what happens when you don't do anything. So for more information, just get a copy of that book, because that book is what some people call the magnum opus, the main book about meditation. It's done really, really well in Vietnam. In Vietnam, it's the text which, when monks actually go to university to learn Buddhism, it's one of the key texts they have to study on meditation. They said, well, you know, that's clear, precise, accurate. They translated it obviously into Vietnamese. And to have a book translated into Vietnamese and sold, you have to get government permission for that. So, you know, the government there know it. And they say it's a really good book, and that's actually why it is put in their universities. It's given accreditation. And that's also why one of my lovely little anecdotes, I was in Vietnam at a conference a few years ago, and when you're in a conference, you don't just present at the conference, you listen to what other people say. And so I was sitting in the back somewhere when waiting for this little session in the conference to begin, and a Vietnamese monk came and sat next to me. I was just friendly and said, oh, where are you from? He asked me. He said, oh, I'm from Australia. This Vietnamese monk spoke pretty good English. He said, oh, you're from Australia. He said, do you know a monk called Ajahn Brahm? That's what he said. And with great joy, I always loved this moment, I turned around to him and said, I am Ajahn Brahm. So I enjoyed that. He was really shocked. What are you, monk? Anyway, it's a very, very good little book about meditation. I'm trying to keep my silence, but my friends keep talking and talking to me about her problems and frustrations. When I told her nicely that we should try to keep our silence, she got offended, but I didn't care. Should I break my silence, become the compassionate auntie agony for her? So now you know who that is. No, I think if you can ask the concierge and get some masking tape, and when she's asleep tonight, put the masking tape over her mouth, a little hole with a straw so she can drink and have some soup. Hello, be kind, whoever that person is. Yeah, I know that you do have problems, but the people here come to meditate and be silent, and quite frankly, that's the best way to overcome problems, to get your answers. Not by asking another person, by letting her to be silent yourself. And listen, the universe always gives you answers to problems, but we're always talking about them, so we don't have a chance to listen. At the next trip I'm doing is to the 10th Global Conference. At the 9th Global Conference, which we held in Perth a few years ago, there were many psychologists came along, and one of them presented his new therapy was just taking people with all sorts of problems in his car to the beach or to the forest, out into the countryside. He called it nature therapy. He never talked to them about solutions to their problems. He never gave them smart techniques to perform when they go home. All he did was take them a walk in the forest. Beautiful parts of nature. Or took them just on the cliffs by the ocean. That's all. Because nature, which is so calming and so peaceful, when the mind became peaceful, they realized that was the solution to their problems. When your mind is agitated, there will always be problems, and you'll never find a solution to them. But when you're silent, all the problems disappear and vanish. You're at peace. You don't get answers to problems by what I'm doing, by answering them. There's always another question will come tomorrow. And as PJ said, on retreats, the questions get more and more and more by the end of the retreat. Why is that? Because I answer to them. Answer to real questions comes from silence. The wisdom born of silence. Some people's teachers. So anyway, please be compassionate to other people and don't keep talking to them. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I experienced two urges to cry today. For no reason. Oh, I thought it was because of one of my jokes. That's a relief. So you cried today for no reason. After tears fell, the urge just vanished. What is happening? Suddenly my body was perspiring as I felt hot throughout your talk. Are the events related? Thank you. The crying is part of the inspiration happiness. And I love telling people that there's two places where I always cry when I go to India. And one of them, for those of you who've been to India, next to Benares, the Museum of Sanat, where the Buddha gave his first sermon, in that museum there's the picture of the Dhammacakka Buddha. It's often when you see it in posters on the front covers of books. It's one of the most beautiful Buddha statues in the world. And to see it, live, and it costs any life to see a statue live, but to see it real world on the picture is quite moving, at least to me anyway. And I remember the first time I went to that part of India and went into that museum, I just went looking for it. And those of you who've been to India, that it's not like the museums in Singapore where you get a guide map and there's all these signs everywhere. No one actually knew where it was, so I had to explore to find it. And actually I turned the corner in that museum and there it was at the end of the hall. I couldn't help myself, I started crying. Tears came down my eyes. It's such a beautiful, beautiful statue. The inspiration of this. And the second time I went on a pilgrimage leading people, I knew exactly where it was. I was really looking forward to it, seeing this beautiful statue, which moves me to tears, literally. But I was with a lot of people, so I thought I'd better behave and restrain myself. So I was prepared for it, but you know, just, okay, come on, just keep your cool. And as soon as I turned the corner, I couldn't help it. Even though I anticipated it, just tears came. It's so beautiful, that statue. And the third time was the best. I knew where it was, and I'm not going to stop it this time, I'm going to enjoy it. The inspirational crying. And I turned the corner and the ceiling was being painted. There was a big cloth all over it, I couldn't see it. I was so disappointed that, oh no, I really wanted my cry. I was looking forward to it. And of course, you can't say anything because there are the workmen there, they can't speak any English. But remember the workman, on a ladder, he looked at me. And without saying anything, without me saying anything, he took the camera off the Buddha statue. I couldn't help it that much. And the other place which I cried is the Vulture's Peak. I don't know why, but you meditate there. That's where the Buddha actually meditated. You can stick where the Buddha sat. No doubt about that. Oh, that's powerful. It really gets me goosebumps. The Buddha, I mean the real Buddha. And you can just put your bottom on the stone where the Buddha would have sat. Wow, that's really crazy. That's amazing. So anyway, those are places that get so inspired. There's nothing wrong with inspirational crying. So, go for it. It's good for you. But if your heart is just a body doing its thing, sometimes there's a whole talk I should give on this about the healing effects of deep meditation. Sometimes it's hot spots in the body where you're meditating. There's parts of your body, maybe your shoulder. It's like a fever, but just located in one part of the body. And you ask the person afterwards, "What happened? I had a hot spot in my shoulders. Why? Weird. Not my shoulders. Nothing else was hot." Then he said, "When did you have your car accident?" "I never told you that." "You got psychic powers. Now last, I know. You let me know now." It's not psychic powers. You have hot spots because of injuries. And when you get really peaceful, you let your body go, it starts just before it disappears. Now your body can heal itself. One of the biggest problems to healing is you, always getting in the way, stopping things happening. You let go so much, really a lot, you get this. So many women have told me this. It's inspiring, a hot spot in one of your breasts. What's that? You ladies have just avoided the breast cancer. I mean that. That's wow, that's big stuff. You're a hot spot. Your body knows how to heal itself, given half the chance. You relax, you let go. You didn't expect this. In a hot spot somewhere in your body. That's only the body healing itself, doing what it should do if you only give it half a chance. So if you did have your whole body got heat, there's probably some cold or virus, but your body just zapped. So when those things happen, just let them happen. Don't use clear, good stuff. Most people have these hot spots after and say, "It was so good afterwards." Exactly. Next question, as I start getting into deeper concentration, please don't use that word, deeper stillness, starting to let go, I seem super sensitive to sound. Excellent. Even the hall door swinging shut can be extremely jarring. If we've got something close to severe stress reaction, please help. You do start to get, anything gets amplified. Sounds. Really hear them. And smells. Then just everything is exaggerated. That's a good sign because after that's just a little one, wait a little while longer, and then the sound starts to disappear. Then you can still hear the door bang, but it's like 1,000 miles away. You hear people coming, going, but they're just so distant. So this is when the senses start to shut down. First they get amplified because your mindfulness is getting strong, and then they vanish. So it's always a good sign. Just keep on going, be a little bit more patient. But also, for those of you who do come in and go out, as PJ was saying, please remember to be like a burglar. Burglars can come in and go out without anybody knowing. So you must be much higher quality human being than a burglar. So if burglars can do it, surely you can. So that's how we do get centered. That's a good sign. Just keep on going. Soon you won't be able to hear anything. You said the nature of the mind is to be still, but why is it called a monkey mind? The Buddha never called it a monkey mind. That came much later. A restless mind. And it reminds me of the story. From Sri Lanka, it was Waisak Day, and on Waisak Day, that's, you all know Waisak Day, just held it just last month, and that's always a big celebration, and on big celebrations, there's always lots and lots and lots of food. So the monkeys in the jungle, knowing they want a good meal that day, go to the temple on Waisak Day. There's always someone's going to leave something there. There's really good pickings where people drop a mango or the leaf of banana on a plate for long enough, that's great for the monkeys. Here he goes to Bodhinyana Monastery. For lunchtime, all the parrots and the kookaburras and the magpies and the crows, they all come. They know what time it is. The rest of the day, you don't see them. They're gone. So they know where to get a good feed. So as the monks, we go there at the same time too. Exactly the same. Sometimes I think that monasteries are the same as zoos. Become feeding time for the, not the monkeys, the monks. And then, anyway, so a monkey came to the temple on Waisak Day, and on a Waisak Day, whoever's the monk there or the nun has to give a talk, and the monk was giving a talk about the monkey mind. And the monkey thought, hey, they're talking about me. You know what it's like when people are talking about you, get interested. So the monkey got closer and started listening to what this monk was saying. And he was talking about the monkey mind being a big obstacle to meditation. It was a bad mind. It was a sort of mind which you're supposed to get rid of. And the monkey said, what are you doing calling monkey minds bad? I'm a monkey, and I know monkey minds are okay. This is discrimination. It's slander. It's defamation. We should do something about this. Complain to the World Wildlife Fund or something, because I'm not standing for this. In a modern world, you can't discriminate because of people's race or gender or sexual orientation or age. Or race, you can't do this anymore. This is a modern world. You can't even discriminate. Just because I'm a monkey doesn't mean my mind is any worse than your mind, humans. I'm not standing for this. So the monkey was so angry. He went into the forest to see the rest of his friends, a troop of monkeys, and when the other monkeys heard about this, they were also really angry. Human beings can't treat us like this. They don't know what they're talking about. Monkey mind is a good mind. Why do you keep making sure it's a bad mind? This is not right. This is wrong. They were jumping up and down, getting more and more angry. And the old monkey, the leader, said, see, those humans are right. That's the monkey mind, jumping up and down, getting angry. And all the other monkeys said, yeah, you're right. We've all got monkey minds. That's why we call monkeys. What can we do about this? And the head monkey said, well, actually, I've been to that temple too. And I've heard, that the way to overcome a monkey mind is to meditate. So all the monkeys jump up and say, yeah, good idea, let's meditate. Yeah, we're going to meditate. Whoa, we're going to meditate. Shut up. So how do we meditate? So I said, first of all, you need a cushion. Get a cushion first of all. Say, yeah, they jump up and down. Yeah, let's get a cushion. We get a cushion. Yeah, let's get a cushion. More monkey mind. And then they all went into the forest. They got leaves and grass and made nice little cushions for themselves. Now what do we do? And the head monkey said, well, you know, sit down on it. So they all sat down, cross your legs. Yeah, left, right paw over the left paw. Bunch back straight, heads down, to watch your breathing. And that jungle had never been so quiet ever before. The monkeys were actually meditating for about 30 seconds. And then one monkey put their hand up. I've got a question. What's the question? He said, well, you know that we planned to go to the banana plantation today, to steal all the bananas, to raid it for our lunch. Well, I keep thinking about that. I know it's not lunch time yet, but I keep thinking about that. So let's go to the banana plantation now, steal all the bananas, get that out of the way first, so then we can meditate. Yes, and all the other monkeys, I was thinking the same, good idea. So they all got off their seats, swung over to the banana plantation, stole lots and lots of bananas, brought them back to their clearing where they lived, put them in the bin, it wasn't lunchtime yet. They're just going to have a way. put in the bean heap, went back to the little sattva, which is their meditation cushions, sat down, right leg over the left leg, in four lotus, right paw over the left paw, arms like that. Back up, close your eyes, chin down, watching their breath. Excuse me, said another monkey after 30 seconds. I've been thinking, you know, before we eat those bananas, we have to peel them. So let's get it out of the way first of all. Yeah, good idea, said all the other monkeys. Let's get it out of the way, then we can meditate. So they all jumped off of their cushions, peeled all the bananas, didn't eat them yet. Put them in a nice big heap, ready for after meditation, so they could have a nice lunch. And they went back to meditate. Right paw over the left paw, thumbs touching, back straight, chin down, watching their breath. Breathing in. Excuse me, said another monkey. I've been thinking too. Before we eat those bananas, we can't eat them yet, not much time. Before we eat them, we have to put them in our mouths. Let's put them in our mouth first. Get that out of the way. Good idea, I've been thinking the same, said all the other monkeys. So they all got up and got a banana, put it in their mouths. You know what people are like, you can see them at lunchtime, people on retreat here. They don't take one banana, they take about two. One monkey took three and stuffed it in his mouth. But you need to get. And then with bananas in their mouth, they went to sit down on their little cushions, right leg over the left leg, the right paw on the left paw, thumbs touching, back stretching down, watching their breath. And of course, once they all closed their eyes, those bananas disappeared. And that's what the monkey mind really is. I'll get this out of the way first, and then I'll meditate. That's the monkey mind. That's a little story of monkey mind. Other than meditation, how to overcome fear of height and fright, especially during takeoff on an aircraft. You know, one of the great ways of doing that is, you know, number one, it's not alcohol. Because many people, if they are afraid of flying, they take alcohol to try and overcome their fears. But this is what happens. Because one of my mates was coming back from Adelaide, visiting family. And when I picked him up from the Perth airport, I had to ask him, "You smell of whiskey. What have you been doing? You haven't been drinking the free whiskey on the flight, have you, Mark?" He said, No. I was put in economy class sitting next to this gentleman who was terrified of flying. Who told me that the only way he could overcome his fear of flying is taking lots of whiskey, which was free on the flight. So this guy had many, many glasses of whiskey. He had another one in his hand when they were coming into land at Perth Airport when the flight hit turbulence and his glass of whiskey went all over my robe. So said the monk. That was his excuse and that's what he stuck to. I'm a bit wondering whether So please, don't drink whiskey as a way of overcoming your fear of flying. Now, one of the reasons, and probably the best way, is to get some hypnotic regression, because usually the case is you're afraid of flying because sometime in the past you did die, you know, in an aircraft crash. And especially in military, wartime, so many people sort of die, you know, in plane crashes during wartime. So that could be you. That's why you're afraid of flying. Imagine all those people in MH, what was it? The one which disappeared? When they get reborn, maybe they'll just be afraid of flying MH. SQ welcome to that. What is it? I don't know, but that's usually, you get hypnotic regression. It's weird that even if you don't believe in rebirth, even that people whose religions don't allow them to believe in rebirth, they still do hypnotic regressions and they get back to what looks like a past life, whether they believe it or not, whatever the phobia is, tends to disappear. So that's a good way of overcoming that. Meditation will also work as well. When meditation with your voice is guided, for the first 10 seconds I feel so sad till my tears drop. I'm not thinking anything sad, it only takes 10 seconds and after that my feeling becomes normal again. It happens in these 3 days. Why, Ajahn? Oh, I was told that many times when I was a young monk I made many girls cry. Maybe you were a girl, was that why? My sexy voice. No, I don't know what it is. It's only been 10 seconds, it will disappear after a while, unfortunately. It could be many reasons. Is it tears of joy, or is it tears of fear? I don't know what those tears are. Sometimes it's tears of joy, sometimes it's something very, very deep inside you. You notice you've heard this before, and this is an amazing thing you're hearing. You recognize stuff, not consciously, but this is important for you, and that's one of the reasons why you may be crying. Oh, you do feel so sad. Feel sad. I wonder why that is. Maybe it was because, you know, maybe the previous life you were maybe a monk and nun and just gave it all up. You recognize things and it's sad that you lost an opportunity, but you know, you're going to get the opportunity again. It's no problem there at all. 32 more questions, so we're going to be in time today. Our kids are averse to praise when we acknowledge a good effort from them or a job well done. They get genuinely angry when we praise them. They also have a negative outlook on situations most times. What can we do as parents to help? Just wear them down with praise. You may praise them, they may reject it on the surface. But they will remember that. The mum and dad praised them, encouraged them. So, I don't know, maybe they think you're up to something. That you're praising them to get something out. What do you mean by this? What are you after? Because if your boss praises you, and it's out of character with them, they say, oh, you're such a wonderful worker. Uh-oh, what's he trying to do? They get very suspicious. You're one of my best workers. Yeah? A great worker. Can you work the weekend? Because sometimes people use praise as a way of getting their own way. But if it really is genuine praise, and they get angry, so it doesn't matter, you get angry at me, but this is how I feel about you, son. You know, I'm very happy that you're just such a great son. So I'll leave that with you. I can give it to you, it's up to you how you use that. You get angry if you want to, you can get sort of whatever you want, but I'm encouraging you to praise other people. Because praise goes a long way in this world. There was one of my monks, what happened to him, that's why he was in hospital for a few days, and when he came out of hospital, I forget what it was, and he said, yeah, they really treated me well in hospital, because I think it was from overseas. All the nurses and doctors were so kind and considerate. I said, well, why didn't you write to someone to say thank you? So he decided to go to the top. He wrote to the Minister of Health in Australian government. I thought it was a crazy thing to do, but I was one that was crazy because he showed me a letter from the minister. Personal. Thank you so much for appreciating the hospital system. All I ever get is complaints. So thank you for doing that. So praise does get you everywhere. You said that when facing uncertainties we need to think positively. Could you elaborate how? Oh, right. I don't know if you remember, I think maybe you remember, I know Angie remembers, during the SARS crisis? You remember that? And some cases, yeah, I was giving a series of 4 talks. Those were, I had a face like the back of a bus. Because you put adverts on the back of the buses in Singapore. And imagine how much money would have cost to organize all of that. And that was right in the middle of the SARS crisis. And I remember on the aircraft coming from Perth to Singapore, I got a copy of the Straits Times in the big black letters. 99 people have now confirmed the SARS. And I read schools had all been shut down. And the government of Singapore had encouraged people to have no public meetings. Stay at home. And there, I think, I never seen anybody so worried. Because they put a lot of effort into organising this. Middle of the SARS crisis, and they just asked me point blank, should we cancel? Should we cancel? And my answer was, and I remember this, I don't know, were you at the airport also, Eileen? Yeah. Remember I asked what the population of Singapore was? Because sometimes people think I elaborate and make up these stories. I think it was 4 million or something at the time. And I said, well, 99 people have got SARS and 4 million people in Singapore. That means 3,999,901 people haven't got SARS. The odds are in our favour. Let's go ahead and do it. There's a classic two bad bricks in the wall story. Fear, negativity. You just see what might go wrong. 99 people got SARS. Ah! But 3,999,901 people hadn't got SARS. That was the number I was focusing on. That's called positive thinking. And anyway, SARS, sudden acute respiratory syndrome. It's a respiratory disease. And what's the best way of overcoming respiratory diseases? Exercise your lungs. Laugh a lot. So I tell so many jokes and funny stories. People laugh so much, I created immunity. And so many of the people came to my talks. But actually it was a success. Well, the first night was not so much, but the last night was almost full. So that's actually how you think positive. That's an example. Doesn't mean expect that and think that positive result will happen. I know people made a lot of money in the secret, but the secret goes a bit too far. But it's so true that if you think positive thoughts, you're asking to get a coach of any football team, any tennis player. If they think they're going to lose, there's no hope for them. If they think they have a chance, we all have a chance. Positive, who knows, it may happen. Then of course, it does happen. That's why negative thinking will always take away your motivation, your drive, your innovation. It can't be done. And of course, it won't be done. So does it mean be neutral thinking, not sure whether positive stuff will happen? No, just realize that the positive results, usually the ones which do happen, the negativity, very unlikely will happen. 22 people died in Manchester in a terrorist explosion. How many people didn't die? So it's still pretty safe. I think since that terrorist explosion in Manchester, I'm sure more people have died in car accidents. Since that time. We're not afraid of driving in a car. But sometimes people are afraid of going to tourist hotspots. Because, terrorists, the chance of it happening there is so small. So that's actually how you have the positive thinking. And it's realistic thinking as well. As many people say that fear is irrational. The chances of you dying in a terrorist explosion in this life are far less than you dying. I think someone worked it out, like lightning strikes. A lightning strike kills more people than those who died in terrorist attacks. Well, these are other things which happen in life, but somehow or other, because lightning strikes are part of nature and say we can't avoid it, because of the terrorist attacks, we think we can avoid it. That's why we think it's a tragedy. Anyhow, that's enough for tonight. It is 21:59. No, it's 10 o'clock. Right on time. I'll make a good Singaporean. Sadhu. Very good. So have a wonderful night. And please don't talk too much to one another. So you can have a good night's sleep and enjoy some time.